your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
If there is a word that is emblematic of the zeitgeist, it's diversity. It's become as American as apple pie. But some believe that diversity has some aspects that are less examined and yet still are worthy of consideration. One such person is Heather McDonald. She holds a BA from Yale, MA from Cambridge, a JD, that's a law degree, from Stanford. She is the Thomas Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the author of the new book, The Diversity Delusion. Heather McDonald, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, thank you for having me on, Marty. I appreciate it.
My pleasure indeed. There are two paragraphs in that book in which you kind of summarize what you believe to be diversity, the diversity efforts in the U.S. workplaces. They start on the second to last paragraph on page 94. You want to kick things off by starting to read those two paragraphs?
Sure, I'd love to.
Thank you.
One would have difficulty finding an elite institution today that does not pressure its managers to hire and promote as many blacks and Hispanics as possible. Nearly 90% of Fortune 500 companies have some sort of diversity infrastructure, according to corporate diversity trainer Howard Ross. The Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission requires every business with 100 or more employees to report the racial composition of its workforce. Employers know that empty boxes for blacks and other underrepresented minorities can trigger governmental review. Some companies tie manager compensation to the achievement of diversity. If people miss their diversity and inclusion goals, it hurts their bonuses, Miles White, the CEO of Abbott Laboratories, said in a 2002 interview. Since then, the diversity pressure has only intensified. Google's objectives and key results for managers include increased diversity. Walmart and other big corporations require law firms to put minority attorneys on the legal teams that represent them. Quote, we are terminating a firm right now, strictly, because of their inability to grasp our diversity expectations, Walmart's general counsel announced in 2005. Any reporter seeking a surefire story idea can propose tallying up the minorities in a particular firm or profession. Silicon Valley has become the favorite subject of bean-counting exposés, though Hollywood and the entertainment industry are also targets of choice, especially in the Me Too era. Organizations will do everything possible to avoid such negative publicity.
There is both in the text and in the reading of it, although you are were kind of restrained, there is a sense that you're disparaging of it. Many people believe that that is to be celebrated, that there is it's a way to address income inequality, the longstanding legacy of slavery, the remaining institutional racism, and therefore this is to be celebrated. You're not so convinced.
Not when standards are being compromised, not when double standards are being employed, which is very, very frequently the case. The fact is that anybody who is hired or admitted to a school on the basis of a preference, and I would include gender, is operating under a stigma. I know that I have been the so-called beneficiary of gender preferences. I've been put on panels or asked to contribute to things simply because of my sex. I find that insulting and demeaning, and we have many books that have been written by blacks, such as Stephen Carter at the Yale Law School, Affirmative Action Baby, that spoke about the psychological challenge this poses of never being confident that you have been hired because of your qualifications as opposed to the color of your skin.
Isn't a reasonable counter to that, though, that what you're describing as a non-merit-based decision based on your gender is really not merit-based only if we're looking in a very narrow sense as to what competence is? For example, in the sciences or whatever, there are different perspectives that a woman brings to the table, that an African-American, that a Latino brings to the table in discussions, in planning, whether it be products or nonprofit, where the nonprofit efforts should be. So, you know, isn't it a little simplistic to define a competency merely in terms of those narrow criteria that that conservatives tend to invoke?
Well, first of all, I don't regard being female as an accomplishment. or an achievement? Number two, do you think you know how I'm going to think because I'm female? I thought that, you know, the diversity advocates are quite vacillating in their prescriptions as to what racial identity is supposed to be. On the one hand, they tell us that race is a construct, and yet these diversity programs do typecast people and assume that you are bringing in a certain type of thought or perspective by hiring on the basis of skin color. There was a very reckless manager, the corporate diversity manager at Apple, who in the last year got herself in trouble by actually stating that a group of, say, two dozen white men in a room may be as diverse as any other type of combination. This was a complete violation of the diversity mantra, which holds that the most important aspect of somebody's self is race or gender. But I am not going to predict the way you think on the basis of your skin color or the way a black person thinks.
Well, of course, there's no question that there is great diversity within a group, within a racial group, an ethnic group, and across the genders. But there is a reasonable assertion that can be made that as a group, women, if underrepresented, are having a set of opinions and perspectives that if indeed well underrepresented in a workforce, that deprive that workforce of merit. Is that not a fair assertion?
Well, the place where this is concerns me the most is in the sciences. There is not a single research laboratory in the country, whether it's on campus or off, that is not under enormous pressure from the National Science Foundation, if it's a university department, from the school's diversity enforcers, to hire by gender and race. I do not believe that there's a black way of doing physics or a female way of studying dark matter. And the problem is with these diversity mandates in the STEM fields, we are putting our competitive edge at risk. There are, when it comes to race, sadly, and this is an uncomfortable topic to talk about, and the facts are kept well off out of the public view, there are very large academic achievement gaps. We can discuss what the reasons are, but at this, at you know, time two, when you're looking at admitting somebody to a physics department or a computer science department, the number of black PhDs that are graduating in these fields is minuscule. For example, in 2016, there were three blacks in the entire country who got a PhD in computer engineers. There were 17 blacks who got a PhD in computer science. That's 1% of the total. Those small numbers reflect achievement gaps that start in elementary school with regards to math qualifications, which are at least a standard deviation in test scores below that of whites and Asians. So if you're pressuring scientific labs to hire on the basis of race and by gender, because you also have gaps in the very highest reaches of math accomplishment. In the U.S., there are 2.5 males for every one female in the 0.01% of math abilities, which is where the cutting edge of work gets done. Those types of quota pressures are putting our competitive edge at risk, because I can guarantee you, Marty, China, for all its problems, and it is, you know, in many respects a society of state power and patronage, when it comes to science, it is looking for one thing. Are you the best computer engineer? Are you the best physicist out there? And they don't care what the person's race or gender is.
Implicit in that, for example, the issue that there is, that it should be defined by competence by whether you've gotten this PhD in physics or whether you're a woman. In the end, there has been a set of arguments that say that, for example, that the men on average tend to be more competitive and less collaborative, and especially in STEM, where answers to complex problems are going to require ever greater complexity, ever greater collaboration. While, of course, there are individualist, competitive women, that in general, having more women in the sciences will lead to that collaboration that, in addition to pure IQ or GRE scores, may be an important ingredient in solving those science problems. What's your reaction?
Well, that's a new argument. I haven't heard that one yet. I would say that we have accomplished the National Science Foundation, which is on now a absolute diversity craze. It is awarding hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to study intersectionality and microaggressions in STEM, which I think is a preposterous, tragic waste of money. Before it got on this diversity craze, it sponsored 200 Nobel laureates who discovered dark matter and the genetics of viruses. These people were working in labs, but there was no mandate to do group work. I think scientists are able to accomplish what they do. I don't know about Einstein being in a team or a some sort of collaborative mandated structure. The fact of the matter is that a large amount of theoretical thinking in physics and math is a solitary activity. If the lab needs to collaborate, fine. Let it hire the people whom it thinks is best able to do so. But to start with gender and race as a important element in a job search, I think, is the wrong way to go about it.
Isn't it an inadequate argument to argue that because in the past there have been many discoveries in male, overwhelmingly dominated science fields, that the discoveries might not have been faster and perhaps, more beneficial in the larger scheme of things? Maybe, we know that men created the Manhattan Project and used nuclear weapons. Is it possible that different kinds of discoveries might have been made that might be more salubrious to the world, and perhaps those that were made might have been, because it's long not been a solo activity, might not have, things have been better had there been more, yes, gender and racial diversity?
Not at the expense of qualifications. I'm sorry. I just do not think that gender and race are relevant to scientific discoveries. And this is a hypothetical that is so abstract, one can't begin to counter it, because you can always posit some cure for Alzheimer's disease, say, that would have happened 50 years ago or 25 years ago by setting up your thought experiment in such a way that positing females that have somehow collaborative instincts that males don't, that would have solved Alzheimer's. Frankly, I'm skeptical, and I would also say that what science has accomplished is of such stunning virtuosity and triumph over the limitations of nature, the frailties of the human flesh, that I am not about to second guess that and say, oh, it could have been much better. As for the Manhattan Project, that's a question of politics. That was still good science, and arguably, I mean, there are strong arguments to be made. I'm agnostic, but that the development of nuclear weapons was essential to saving the world and the prospect of liberal democracies.
There was one other argument you made a minute or two ago that I feel should also be politely questioned, and that is you used as evidence of the lack of African Americans in computer science. I think you said there were a total of three graduates in computers, PhDs in computer science that were African Americans, as evidence that they don't have the ability. Isn't that a pipeline question? Doesn't that really justify the very NSF major funding for enhancing diversity that you were decrying, so that people of all races feel they can succeed in the non-traditional, in fields in which African Americans are traditionally underrepresented?
No, the pipeline question is solved not by at the back end, at the at the final part of the question, when you do not have sufficiently qualified blacks. I mean, where, again, three PhDs. So every computer science engineering department in the country is claiming that it needs to hire black PhDs. So where are they going to get them? They're not out there. The solution to this is to start an elementary school, to change a family culture that in many instances is insufficiently attentive to academic achievement. The whole acting white stigma is extraordinarily hurtful. We need schools with better discipline in the classroom so that the many, many students who are there to learn can do so without disruption. But you're not going to solve this by putting people into academic environments for which they're unprepared. I mean, your arguments have been tested in undergraduate and law school environments, where every college in the country is employing very large racial preferences to admit black and Hispanic students. And those preferences are harming their alleged beneficiaries. This is not a race issue, it's a preference issue. If MIT decided that it needed more females and admitted me to fill its gender quota, and my math SAT was 650 on an 800-point scale, and my peers in my freshman year at MIT had been admitted on a gender-blind basis, and they had 800s, that is, top scores in math, and that's probably pretty typical. MIT's undergraduates ace the Putnam exam, which is the undergraduate, very prestigious math exam. What was going to happen to me with my 650 math SATs in a sea of 800s? I am going to flounder in my first year. I'm not going to be able to keep up because the teaching is going to be pitched to the average of my classmates who have done much, much better and are better prepared. If instead of going to MIT, I'd been admitted to a school not on the basis of my gender but on my academic qualifications, 650 is a respectable score. If I'd been admitted to, say, Boston University or Boston College, where my peers also had 650 SATs, I'd have a much better chance of completing a science major instead of dropping out and deciding I wasn't set out for a science career and going forward with it. We see the exact same thing happening with blacks and racial preferences. There was a very sophisticated study done at Duke that showed that black males, freshmen, come into Duke at a rate of wanting to major in a science field that's higher than white male Duke admits. But by the time of graduation, the number of blacks graduating in a science field is extremely low because the blacks have switched majors. Why? Because they're admitted with math SAT scores and academic test scores that are two standard deviations below those of their white and Asian peers.
That is
unfair to those students. It is unfair to expect them to keep up. They end up in the bottom of their class this is not something that breaks down racial stereotypes.
You know, you talk about this, the difference in test scores. Again, I'm concerned about too narrowly defining competence. But first, I should let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. We're talking about the under-examined side of our attempts to create more diverse workforces. As you know, on this show, I like to present not necessarily the things you're always going to hear in other venues, but to talk about the under-discussed in hopes of providing some balance. I've got a conservative person here who is the author of a book called The Diversity Illusion. Her name is Heather McDonald, but I'm trying to do my best to both allow her to present her ideas, but also to ask as hard questions from the more traditional liberal perspective so that you, my dear listeners, can come away with a full-dimensioned exploration of this. You know, you talked about admissions, and one of the things we know is that a prestigious degree opens career doors. Well, you write about a lawsuit that is currently in the courts that is being brought by Asian Americans against Harvard. And in that, they hired a Princeton statistician, Andrew Card, who I happen to know is a liberal, calculated that if race weren't considered in Harvard admission, the Asian rate of admission would increase by 108%. What should Harvard, or any university where this might be also true, what should they take, if they were talking to the pool of human beings who happen to be of Asian background, who, if it weren't for their race, they would have been admitted, what would you, if you were the admissions officer at Harvard, what would you say to that pool of Asian students?
Well, if you're honest, you'll say we're discriminating against you and you are going to have to come with academic qualifications that are magnitudes higher than any other racial or ethnic group. Test scores that would be automatically disqualifying for an Asian student are, in many cases in schools across the country, automatic admissions for blacks and Hispanics. You know, Asians know this, and high school students know this. You know, schools have spent the last 40 years covering up the reality of racial preferences and the outcome of students that are admitted with these preferences, which is very bad. But you talk to any high school student, they compare their SATs, they see who's getting into which schools. They absolutely know how this game is rigged. And the sad part is that this is only going to really widen the academic achievement gap, because Asians are now held to the highest of all standards, and so they are studying even harder. They are picking up more, you know, classical music instruments. They're playing not just piano and violin, but they're probably now adding trombone.
You know, I'm going to interrupt you because I'm looking at the clock. I'd like to give our listeners an opportunity to weigh in. We only, you know, you've asked me to keep this to a half hour, so I will. But I would like to invite to at least one or maybe two phone calls. So if you've been listening to this interview and you would like to weigh in and with either a question or a comment, all that we don't care what your perspective is as long as it's respectfully dispensed. If you have a question or a comment for Heather McDonald, the author of The Diversity Delusion, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to, you know, the latest iteration, well, the calls are coming in, but while the latest iteration of race, gender, and sexual orientation workshops in the workplace is something called implicit bias. Being as fair-minded as you can be, what should we know about this concept of implicit bias?
Well, the implicit bias concept rests on a computer test that some of your listeners may have taken, Marty, either on the workplace or by themselves, called the implicit association test, and it flashes pictures of whites in the race IAT, there are several many versions of the implicit association test, but in the race one, you're shown pictures of white and black faces very quickly on a computer screen, and you're supposed to respond with two keys to categorize them as white and black. You're then also shown a series of negative and positive words, which you also categorize by two keys on the computer keyboard. And the IAT has tended to show that people taking the exam are faster in associating and categorizing black faces and white faces when the keys that they're using are also associated with, in the case of whites, positive terms, in the case of blacks, negative terms. And this has been presented by the IAT architects and the vast industry that has picked up on it as proof that even though people may think of themselves as colorblind or not acting on racial prejudice, that in fact their thinking is pervaded by racial prejudice, and that this is going to have an effect on the decisions they make in the world with regards to hiring and other aspects.
Okay, just in interest of time, I'm going to let that. So while there's no, in social science research especially, things are very complex, but if there's a general tendency for people in controlled situations to indeed associate more positive attributes with whites than with blacks, isn't that some evidence that implicit bias is indeed operative?
Well, the test has been completely deconstructed by social scientists. I mean, it fails the two basic criteria of any psychometric test, which is reliability and validity. It turns out that it's not reliable, meaning that any given test taker can take it many times, and his scores are going to vary massively, way beyond anything that is viewed as statistically reliable. It is not valid in that it does not predict behavior. The architects of the test have been forced to acknowledge that it should not be used to make any predictions about an individual's behavior, because in these very artificially simulated psychological lab settings that try to test for prejudiced behavior, there is no connection between somebody's score on an IAT and the decisions they're actually making.
Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Heather McDonald. What is your question or comment for her?
Hello. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For taking my call. My name is Janica Schneider. I'm a scientist. And I would like to say that I don't agree that there isn't a female or a black way of doing science. I think that when we do science, we bring our cultural background into how we solve problems. We bring a lot to the table, and not just our technical training. And to say that there is, you know, there isn't, that there aren't differences, and that diversity isn't important, I think is quite untrue. Another point I want to make.
Because we have our lines lighted up, and my guest has wanted to get off at the 30-minute mark. That's a very articulately stated point, Heather. What is your response to her point that I've made throughout this half hour, that there is more than test scores to defining contribution to the workplace?
Well, again, with regards to science, I just don't know. I mean, I'm just skeptical of that. I think that science is a universal language. It is the language of rationality, and, you know, we will see. You know, maybe there's going to be female science in the future or black science in the future, but I suspect that what counts really is people's scientific abilities, and those are distributed throughout populations, and I am not willing to use race and gender as a surrogate for scientific ability.
Let's take one more call. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What's your question or comment for Heather McDonald? Are you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I had a question that sort of went off at the last person. So
I'm not hearing you very clearly. Can you either speak more into the microphone or close, turn your off your radio or do something to sound better?
Yeah, can you hear me better now?
Much better.
Hi, thank you. So I wanted to ask if college is about sort of exposing students to other ideas and people, how is that taken into consideration if we're only looking at the test scores?
Heather?
Well, because I think that when you lower standards, which is what happens, and bring in students as a group based on irrelevant characteristics like race or gender, and those students are not competitive academically, they end up at the bottom of their class. It turns out the SATs actually overpredict black performance. You know, one of the arguments for racial preferences is that the SATs are culturally biased, and therefore blacks will do better than their SATs. The opposite is the case. You know, it would be fine if they were just tiebreakers, but what happens, I mean, I have data in the book about what happens in law schools that also admit blacks with one or two standard deviations in test scores. What happens after their first year, this is based on data that has tens of thousands of data points in it, 51% of black students end up in the bottom tenth of their law school class compared to 5% of white students, and two-thirds of black students are in the bottom fifth of their class. They're two times as likely to drop out as whites. This is not a mechanism for combating whatever remaining racial stereotypes that the populace has. It is not fair to the people who are being admitted under these lower qualifications. Again, if females were admitted with one to two standard deviations in scores below males, the same thing would happen. They would end up at the bottom of their classes. They would do perfectly well. Nobody's saying that underrepresented minorities should not go to college. There are, of course they should, but it is not helping anybody to be catapulted outside of the level of preparation that you're ready with into a more elite college. And what I find amazing about this discourse is the extraordinary snobbery on the part of the most elite colleges that have put out the message that the only way you can succeed in life is to graduate from UC Berkeley or from a Harvard, you know, and that somehow it's a handicap in life to go to UC Riverside or, you know, a Boston college. There's in that case, why don't we close down UC Riverside? Nobody should go there if it's so crippling. But go to a school where your peers match your qualifications, and the teaching will be at your level, which is a perfectly fine level. But this racial engineering is, as far as I'm concerned, its main flaw is not that the reverse discrimination argument and all the elaborate equal protection jurisprudence of the Supreme Court. It is that it does not help its alleged beneficiaries.
I want to, because I do want to respect your desire to get off the phone, but there is one question I feel I should ask, and this is related to gender, which we haven't focused on specifically in terms of the workplace. You know, the media has been giving attention to workplace sexual misconduct, from Harvey Weinstein to Donald Trump to Bill Cosby, John Conyers to Al Franken to Cory Booker, even preeminent PBS interviewer Charlie Rose. And consensus is that this is great. This is a crucial rooting out of what is perceived as a male tendency to assault or at least act inappropriately toward women in the workplace. Isn't that to be celebrated?
Well, yes, if there's active harassment, that is a workplace issue. Sexual predation is wrong. It is oppressive. And in the case of people who are exploiting their hierarchical authority to gain sexual favors or to simply act as an exhibitionist, that is a workplace issue that should be punished. But the solution to that is not to implement gender quotas throughout the economy.
If I want to end with, I've tried to be the what I'm, a journalistic interviewer is supposed to be, a kind of polite skeptic. But if someone is interested in your ideas about the intersection of merit and diversity, other than reading your book, The Diversity Delusion, what would something be you'd suggest that they do?
That is not related to my writings. I mean, again, the book is the sort of the go-to source. But if you really, we've been discussing a lot, without naming it, the problem of mismatch, which is the problems that accrue when you admit any group to an institution for which it is not academically prepared. Again, it is not confined to race. It could happen with gender as well. There's a book by Richard Sander and Stuart Taylor called Mismatch, which also lays this out.
Anyway, I want to thank you. I know it's late East Coast time, and you made a real clear point. You were an early riser, and it's now 10:36 East Coast time, so I want to thank you very much for giving me your late night. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome.
It.
The book is The Diversity Delusion by Heather McDonald, and now we turn to you. I very often, not always, but often try in the first segment of the show to look at the larger societal issues, but I'd never want to lose sight of the fact that you as an individual may or may not have the luxury of merely, elbowing, sitting back and armchairing these discussions, that you personally have a work issue. And one of the missions of this show is to help you with your work life problem. So whether you're 17 or 76, male, female, or anywhere along the non-binary gender continuum, and of course any race or ethnicity or whatever your station in life, forgive the public radio pun, I love to help you with your work problem. I am in my 30th year doing the show, and I think you can tell in the tone of my voice I'm as enthusiastic doing it today as I ever was, and I have the benefit of having all these years of experience, which I can give to you for free now. This is my pro bono work here at KALW. So if you've got a work-related problem, any sort, the phone number here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. It looks like we've got a call on the line already with a work-related question. Then let's go right to the phones. Okay, welcome to the Work with Marty Nemko. How can I help you? Are you there?
Hello?
I guess. Are you there? I guess not. Let's hang up. Okay. I want to talk about a topic that's pretty important. I have had a number of clients whom were just fired. And the standard advice that they've come in to me with has been ineffective for people. And so I want to share what I have had 5,500 clients. I want to share what has helped. I mean, nothing works for everybody. We're dealing with human beings here. But I want to share what is advice that has helped more of my clients to move forward after being fired. First of all, they found that the longer that they process, the standard advice is take time to process, grieve, reassess. But I found that after a fairly small amount of time, the longer that they, quote, process, the harder they find it to move forward. The bad thoughts about how evil their previous boss was or how unfair it was or their own insecurities about themselves, those bad thoughts end up staying top of mind by revisiting and revisiting often the unfairness of it or their own self-recriminations. My clients have found the following more helpful than taking extended time to process. Number one, this sounds extreme, but it has worked for a number of my clients. Allow yourself just 30 minutes if you've just been fired. Obviously, if you've already been fired for 2 weeks, you can't do this. But allow yourself just 30 minutes more of grieving. Be as angry as you want. Be as fearful as you want for a half hour. After that, it's wise to use that anger or fear to fuel your efforts to start moving forward. Now, what should that look like? First, yes, I want you to take a look inward, a hard, honest look, and ask yourself, are there lessons to be learned from your firing? Sure, it could have been caused by a bad employer or a bad fit employer, so the lesson learned can simply be to vet employers more carefully. But really ask yourself, have you been skilled enough, hardworking enough, quick enough, low maintenance enough, ethical enough? And then incorporate any lessons you've learned into choosing your job target, getting the training that you may feel you should have, and what you're going to do differently on your next job. And that doesn't require a long time in exploration, just a bit, so that you're not living in the past, but learning the lessons from it. I'm going to share. I've got much more to share, but I'll just give out the phone. I've got calls on the line, but let me give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem and you want my help with your work problem, I call them a workover. Rarely is pummeling involved, but I will be certainly a straight shooter with you and try to help you take a baby step, maybe even a giant step forward in your work life. The phone number for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's the number here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, so there was the last show was interesting. I wanted to talk about the elephant in the room that I don't think was mentioned.
I really feel like I want to devote this part of the show to helping people with their work problems. I wanted to devote that half hour. We ended up going to 35 minutes talking about that issue. So I'm going to ask you.
Well, I could talk about that. I had experience before that's just related to just what you just said.
Do you have a work-related issue that you'd like my help with?
Well, I had experience that following your advice, I succeeded.
Okay. If you feel it'll help our listeners, please go ahead.
Yeah. I had an internship at NASA Ames, and I was fired from the internship.
At an internship at NASA Ames, you were saying? Okay.
Yeah, a long time ago. And I looked at myself, and part of the reason is they put me in a type of role. I suffer from a learning disability.
Okay.
And I struggle with it, and I felt I was discriminated against. But what I did is I took that anger, that energy, and I said, I'm going to succeed. I don't care what these people stereotype me to be. I'm going to succeed. And what I did is I played with my computers. I learned everything. I took courses. And eventually, within 3 months, I had a job that was three times more in salary.
Wow.
And I was very successful. And the manager and stuff were very accommodating and worked with me.
I'd like to ask you a few questions that will help our listeners.
Sure.
So, what enabled you to get past the or to channel the anger? What did you say to yourself to get past it? And then what specifically did you do in those 3 months to upskill yourself?
So, I was going to the community college. The knowledge I got from NASA, I kind of learned what was the trend, what I should learn.
Hmm.
And so I took courses that aligned to what was in the market at the time.
Hmm. What'd you take? I'm just curious, what'd you take?
Well, back in the day, I was taking Windows certification courses.
Okay.
And so Microsoft called it MCSE. It's a different name, but it's basically certified on maintaining Windows servers, Active Directory, things like that.
Okay.
And also at the time, Unix, Solaris is big, now it's all Linux. But at the time, I took courses on Unix networking, Linux networking, Linux systems. And that was all, in market at the time. And so for me, I kind of I sometimes learn, sometimes don't. I use my computer to play video games or whatever. But I was so angry. I just took that anger and just focused with this pure, that. I just channeled this focus. I said, I'm going to teach these guys. I'm going to succeed and show them I'm going to succeed.
I can't tell you how many clients have said that. When somebody says, you can't do it. You're too this. You're too that. You shouldn't go to college. You shouldn't be this. Sometimes it is that fuels them to prove them wrong. Exactly what you said. And what did you, you say you have a learning disability. What did you do to, when we normally think of learning disability, we think about difficulty in reading, in processing auditorily. What did you do to counteract your learning disability that enabled you to succeed?
Well, during that time, I wasn't able to handle my learning disability, but I was able to get, skill up and get the job and get qualified, and then the manager kind of worked with me. But later, I had an opportunity to go to college full-time. I saw in my life, I said, look, you're not going to succeed unless you could get a more broader background. So I went to college to get that broad background. I had the tech skills, but I didn't have all the other skills. And so when I went to college full-time, I put all my energy. I took 27 hours to do a five-page C paper.
Wow.
And I struggled with it. And I said, okay, there's something wrong. I don't have a job. I have full focus. what's wrong. Mm. I went in, I got tested, found out I had a learning disability. Mm. I found out a support structure of people that actually cared if I succeeded, whereas a lot of the Tech Valley, they don't care. Mm. That I had an instructor that encouraged me and gave me, like, you know, how to do mind maps and ways to do the, you know, look at the information differently. And then what I did is I had to drop out of the course. I started to learn to learn. Then once I did that, at the end of the second time I took it, in 4 hours, I could write a 12-page A paper.
Wow, that's more than you write a quality paper in a 12-page paper in 4 hours. Well, you're a better man than I.
Yeah, and so doing like mind maps, for example, I go through a material, I would study it in a non-linear way. See, I can't follow stuff. If you go, here's like 50 steps, go from 1 to 50, I'll get bored and get sidetracked. But if I could like mind map it, like get all the main points and then all the sub points and the other points, then I could say, well, it's like a buffet. I said, I'm going to learn about this one because this looks interesting. And then I could go to another one and say, I'm going to learn this other thing. And even if I don't get all of it, you know, I got a majority of it. That's going to be an A in a course or a B on a paper with very little effort.
Well, I love to hear success stories. I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Yeah, no problem.
Take care. All right, phone number again. If you've got a work-related problem, I love getting, you know, hearing success stories, but I also like to be helpful. If you want some help, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to give you more advice about what to do if you're fired, but I want to prioritize you, my dear listeners. So let's go back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I'm in a situation at work where I've been with the company for a long time, and there was a recent reorg within the company, and we have a new president now, and major things are shifted around. I was in a really good standing position, and then now I'm in a new role, new department, and I feel like now I'm at a point where I'm getting pushed out.
Okay.
I don't really fit in with the new group.
Skill set or personality? Skill set or where is your misfit personality or skill set?
It's personality, I think.
Okay.
Well, some of it's skill set. I mean, I've done similar stuff, but it's more personality. I'm not jiving with the group of people over there. It's a clique. They just, and I've even had frank conversations with my previous boss about this, and you know, and confided in other people I trust, and they all are in agreement, and had to, you know, go see HR, and had to go see, you know, talk to different people about it.
Okay.
And my boss leads by intimidation by saying, you know, don't go to this person. You got to watch your back. You might lose your job. You know, my initial touch base was, you know, I've been told I'm a bully, so please tell me if I am a bully at any time. I mean, it's just, and it's, now I'm getting bombarded by different projects, overwhelmed, pushed, and like, well, if you can't handle this, then, you know, maybe this isn't the right role for you, even though I've been with the company for 5.5 years before this.
With the goddess,
very well.
Got it. With the goddess within you, there's usually in every click, there is a driver. The person who drives the clique. Should you have a coffee meeting with that person to see if that can be undone? Or do you believe it is a fatal flaw and you must get out? Or do you need to accept it?
Yeah.
And which of those three things do you feel is right for you?
HR, and she suggested having lunch with my boss and doing that there. And she's kind of like the leader of this, and all the other three people are this like sycophantic collection of people who, you know.
That's a fancy word for suck ups. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, and so did you have that meeting?
Yeah, it felt so like the real thing. I mean, and I, you know, she was trying to make an effort, and I was like, okay, you know, I'm willing to do anything to make it work.
Okay.
You know, I'm not willing. You know, maybe I need to adjust. I'm looking within to maybe make some changes within myself.
So is the purpose of your call to simply summarize? Do you know what change you want to make in yourself? And do you know what you're going to ask of your boss in the way of support?
Well, I just think now I feel like I'm at this point where I need to get out of there because
okay.
I just don't think I'm getting supported, and it's just getting worse, and I'm doomed to fail.
Okay, and do you want to, are you calling me in terms of how to get advice, how to get a new job in the same field when you have a boss who may not love you, or do you want to change careers?
Well, I would like to, I mean, I just don't want to be forced out of the situation.
Right.
I want to leave on good terms
right.
if I need to leave. And
right.
I just don't want to be in a situation where I'm bombarded and then being told to leave.
Right.
You know?
So standard practice would be, at this point, to start looking perhaps quietly if you don't want your boss to know. So you start by making a list of some people who you know and who like you, who might refer you into somewhere. You might apply simply online for Stanford jobs where you're a good fit and seeing what happens. And when you get to the end stage and you see you're a finalist and all the only thing that's remaining is they want to check your references and go back to your boss, that's the time to have a nice kumbaya meeting with your boss to explain why,
okay.
to say, I really liked very much working with you because of this, this, and this. I really appreciated the company with this. I appreciate your efforts in trying to make it work. It just wasn't a great fit, and so I'm honored that I've got a great job opportunity that's come my way, and I just want to thank you for your efforts, and sometimes things didn't work, but I know we both made our best effort. Something of that nature, so that when they do call for the reference, she doesn't sabotage you.
Right.
Does that make sense in terms of a timeline?
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. Those are good suggestions.
You're
I
most
really
welcome.
Appreciate it.
And I really appreciate your calling work with Marty Nemko. Okay. I do want to keep prioritizing you. We have calls on the line, so let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello. I just want to ask, I'm going on 49, and I got a lot of friends that are about my age in the Bay Area, and we've all kind of been here and have been suffering the cost of living and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And our professions really didn't take into account this kind of like increase in pricing, and a lot of us are in social services and whatnot, and I've been doing some tech, and I kind of really feel like I'm getting discriminated with ageism in tech, and I don't really know how much that's going to last for me to find a space. And so many of the other people that I know are saying, should we just start over someplace else? And, it's really hard. Or should we, try to go back to school and get some skill set to stay in the Bay Area? And, and both are hard,
hard.
Kind of
absolutely. Jump. Fabulous question, though. Let's talk about you. Let's not lump you in with your peers. I care right now about you. Tell me about how much you love living in the Bay Area. For some people, it is critical for them to live in the Bay Area. For other people, it's not. Let's start with that. Where are you with regard to that?
I love the Bay Area, but I don't have to be here. I pretty much am here for the jobs and all that. But,
I see.
I just kind of feel like I'm getting... I'm scared that I'm going to be just aged out, and so many of the people that I'm dealing with in tech are so much younger.
I know. You're right. I'd be less than honest with you if I told you that it does seem more in tech more than almost anything else for a variety of reasons that go beyond the scope of this call. But if you were to move to a lower cost place to live where you could still see yourself being happy, either because you know people there, you like the culture there, the weather, whatever, what would be a low cost place that you'd be open to living and could see yourself being a contented human being?
I really like warm weather and all that great stuff, but reality is, I lived in Miami for quite a while, and it's also the people. You just if you're in tech, you're kind of like one of those, the mind just keeps going, and when you're in other places like Florida or other places, they just don't think like that.
Right.
It just feels like everybody's so slow, and it's really hard to get people up to speed and be creative with people. It's like being around artists. You want to be around people that can
your people
and move and do things.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've had some success in helping clients who are in your situation move to Austin, Texas, because Austin, Texas is a place in which there is a large cadre, and also the Research Triangle in North Carolina. Those are two low-cost places that have a lot of high-tech and a lot of universities. Obviously, UT Austin is an enormous university, and you've got Duke and the University of North Carolina at the, what's called the Research Triangle down there. Your cost of housing is going to be half or less of what we have here. And also, especially in North Carolina, there is, and in both, there is a tremendous need for social services. So that I wonder whether you could be this IT person there, and yet the market, I mean, the Bay Area is the epicenter for the cutting edge in technology, so they can afford to be very ageist. But I'm wondering whether, I'm not asking you to jump right away, but I'm wondering if a wise thing for you to do would be to go to Indeed.com, search on terms that represent your IT expertise, but also in the social science environment, in Indeed, in those cities, in Austin, in perhaps Madison, Wisconsin, I'm trying to think of places that have a culture that is not dissimilar, or the Research Triangle, to see what's out there. And then that may help you decide whether, no, that's going to make you puke, or that might be a good fit. How's that feel?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good advice. I've been kind of pondering that, but just not really sure if I should just make, you know, both a career jump and a, you know, I won't have much of a, you know, support group in a new area
right.
as well. So
I think I'm a big fan of low-risk action. It's going to cost you no money and no time to do that research. I invite you to get off the phone, go to Indeed.com, look for jobs in Austin and in the Research Triangle in North Carolina. Perhaps even Idaho, around Boise, is where Boise State is, has become a place where that, a lot of that goes on as well. And look for jobs that utilize your IT skills. Use the search terms that utilize your IT skills as well, and perhaps in the nonprofit sector, since you were working in social services. And that's my best shot for you.
All right, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Good. We've only got a little bit of time, so I promised you I was going to give you a little more advice about what to do if you're fired. You really have to wisely choose your job target. Maybe you'll want to try for another job doing what you've been doing, maybe even aiming simply for a higher quality employer so you can say, see, like that previous caller, they were fools to let me go. But also ask yourself whether it'd be wise to do a career tweak. For example, modestly changing the sort of job or employer you want to work for. Even consider whether it's worth the risk of the likely longer job search and lower pay that's likely if you try for a big career change. So, and looking at directories of different careers, whether it be in the government's Occupational Outlook Handbook or my book, Careers for Dummies, could be helpful there. I'm just about out of time. One more tip. You've got to, especially if you've been fired, you've got to network whether you like it or not. People who've been fired have a tough time getting hired if they simply answer job ads or post their availability on LinkedIn or other job sites. Even if you manage to get an interview despite being unemployed, your prospective employer is going to likely contact your former employer who might not provide a glowing review. I'm not saying you need to network necessarily by schmoozing at parties. It could be by making a presentation at a conference. It could be by joining a meetup. But you probably do need to network. And that is all the time we've got. I wish I had more time to. I've got more ideas on what to do if you're fired, but that'll have to wait for another week. So that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7 p.m. You can call in for a workover. Plus, sure, there are going to be jobs for data scientists and other tech whizzes, but in an era of growing automation, offshoring, and gigification of jobs, what's going to happen to the many millions of other people? I'm going to debate that as well as possible approaches to the problem with my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.